This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Today on Word for Word, former President Bill Clinton. Clinton was one of the many big names on the speakers list at this year's Aspen Ideas Festival, a list which also included Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, White House political advisor Karl Rove, and former Secretary of State Colin Powell, whom we featured last week on Word for Word. The Ideas Festival was organized by The Atlantic Magazine and the nonpartisan Aspen Institute. This hour, we'll hear former President Clinton address a wide range of subjects, from growing lawns on city rooftops to the prospect for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Mr. Clinton also spoke about the situation in Iraq and answered criticisms that his administration didn't do enough to combat terrorism. Well, terrorism, in the wake of the attacks allegedly masterminded by a group of doctors in London, was very much in the foreground on July 7th, when former President Bill Clinton spoke in a conversation moderated by Rick Stengel, managing editor of Time magazine.
Let's talk about London for a second, because there are certain assumptions that we've made about terrorism that the recent events in London seem to undermine. One of them is that we thought for a while that we would start getting homegrown terrorism in London, and these fellows were from out of the country. Yesterday, General Powell was talking about people are still lining up around the world to want to come to America. But the question I have is assimilation perhaps not working the way we thought it should? I mean, we all think that someone comes to America, they embody our values, they learn to love America, and they could never turn against us. The Brits feel the same way, yet we're seeing something different now.
But we're not, really. I mean, both things can be true. It only takes one person to set off a car bomb. I mean, we could all figure out how to do it in a matter of 30 minutes. You know, it wouldn't take much instruction to figure out how to put one of those things together and detonate it. So if 95% of all the Muslim doctors who come to the United Kingdom are grateful for the chance to be there and spend their whole life trying to help keep people healthy and save lives, and 4% of them are terrorist sympathizers and 1% of them are prepared to, you know, do what that doctor did in Glasgow and burn himself to a crisp trying to kill some people, doesn't mean that we're not succeeding. It means we're not succeeding completely. Again, I will say this is a question of identity. I think we need more thought given to this. Amartya Sen wrote a great little book last year called Identity and Violence, which I commend to all of you. I don't necessarily agree with his whole analysis, but it will force you to think about how people, even well-educated, prosperous people, superficially well-integrated people, identify themselves in a way that preclude their treating other human beings as equals in non-warlike circumstances. It's a huge problem all over the world. And we need to really think about how we're raising our kids, how we're talking about this. And one of the reasons I like all this explosion of young people getting involved in service in America and around the world is I think that lots of people will see them, particularly in other countries, and it will change their sense of identity. It's a huge problem. I mean, you've got a lot of these people, these doctors were doing pretty well in life, but they did not feel they belonged in the society in which they lived, and they felt morally, emotionally, maybe psychologically impelled to give meaning to their own lives by taking away someone else's. We need to get to the bottom of that. I think it's as old as time. I think, you know, if you go back all throughout human history, there have been our crowd and the others. And one of the ways is, as Robert Wright said in his great book, Non-Zero, basically you could see human history as a struggle to create wider and wider and wider circles of positive interdependence. And at every juncture when we run up against another alien force, somehow we have escaped annihilation. We dodged that bullet in World War I. We dodged the bullet in World War II. We dodged the bullet in the Cold War. And now it's like we're being gnawed at by 1,000 ants. And there's all of whom have the power to, effect the ultimate tragedy on whoever happens to be standing in the way of the bomb. So we're going to have to give a lot more thought to people who live among us but are not of our community because they do not feel they belong. Their identity, their sense of worth, their very sense of what gives their life its force and meaning requires them to be apart.
Well, what do we do about those folks? I mean, do we turn the other cheek? Is the response to 9/11 something that should have been the opposite of that, something that was more forgiving? I mean, how do you assimilate those people? I mean, you yourself have talked a lot about the rise in fundamentalism everywhere. That seems inimical to embracing people.
I think you have to do three things. I think, first of all, let's not be naive here. If somebody's trying to kill you, you don't have time to change your mind. So you've got to have a security policy. But what did we learn from Afghanistan and Iraq and from all the arrests that have been made in the last 10 years and all the terrorist incidents that have been prevented? That most of them have succeeded because of cooperation and law enforcement, intelligence, and people tracking money. 95% of all the people suspected of paying terrorist assaults in the United States have been arrested by somebody else in some other country working closely with our people. Hillary got some grief in one of the debates recently where she said she thought Americans were more secure than we were on 9/11 from domestic attack, but not secure enough. That's because of all this work that's done by all these people you'll never know unless you happen to be related to one of them. You don't even know what they're doing. But these thousands and thousands of anonymous people are out there killing themselves every day trying to keep you safe and keep you alive, and that's working. You have to be prepared to use military force, but it ought to be a last option, not a first option, because it's the most expensive thing you can do, and there are always unintended consequences. But you still got to be prepared to do it. So I think that you have to have a security policy. Then you have to have a policy to make more partners and fewer terrorists. It really does matter. Even though all these people were well-educated, and I know all that, they still feed on this sort of the zeitgeist of resentment in their culture. So when you work to overcome the inequalities of education and health and economy, it matters. It makes a difference. Keep in mind, arguably America's most successful military operation in a Muslim country, except for getting rid of the Taliban in Afghanistan in this decade, was the military's humanitarian airlift in Indonesia after the tsunami. A poll done there when the president asked his father and me to go raise money for that. And we did, and we funded some projects, and we went over there and did our little, fact-finding tour, and we came back to the White House. On the way in, the USAID man who had been our point person handed me a survey completed the day before in Indonesia. It said that America's popularity had gone from 30% before the tsunami to 60% after, solely because people saw us trying to help them start their lives again. Again, it doesn't mean you don't need a security policy, but this works. And the third thing I think we have to do is amorphous and uncertain of result, but we have to try to all think about and flush out this whole question of identity. How do we see ourselves in relation to other people? What are the sources of meaning in our lives? How does our self-definition lead us off a cliff or into the embrace of our fellow human beings? It's a huge problem everywhere. And that's why I think, one of the great tragedies of the last few months is that the Hamas and the Fatah are now fighting each other. They don't even have time to jump on the Israelis anymore. But what it means is it's going to be almost impossible to work out a near-term settlement in the Middle East at a time when the external factors are highly favorable to it. All the Sunni Arabs are dying to recognize Israel, normalize, establish security and economic partnerships because they're worried about Iran. And the internal politics are not working for us. And that feeds what goes into people's mental processes as they define what it means to be in the community of the United Kingdom as opposed to the community of Islam, as the most community of oppressed Muslims or Arabs or you name it. We've got to just keep working on this. Most people don't live like we do. Most people will never get to come to a meeting like this and think highfalutin, broad-minded, generous thoughts about one another. But they are basically just as good as we are. And they need to be given a chance, especially children, not only to learn at a rational level, but to feel that their life has more meaning if they think our common humanity is more important than our interesting differences. It's a massive problem. And it's at the root of, if you look at every single trouble spot in the world, that's where it is.
Let's talk about the trouble spots. I'd love to get to a happier subject, but we're still on this. What are the most dangerous places in the world right now, and what should we do about them? I mean, off the top of my head, I mean, you mentioned Iran. Iraq is a festering wound. Pakistan is a dangerous place, as you know. What can we do about those places, and are there other places that we haven't even mentioned?
Well, first of all, it's... Depends on whether you're talking about today or 10 or 20 years from now. Let's assume you mean in the present. So you have to worry about... Iraq is dangerous because of its uncertain corollary consequences. It's a tragedy, which is different from being a danger to the whole world. But I noticed, I read in a paper what General Powell said about this the other day. I think we have no choice but to withdraw a substantial number of our military forces there this year. I think that... Wait, let me finish. We have no ground forces with which to confront an unforeseen security challenge. Our naval personnel are training in traditional Army tactics. I met a young officer at a healthcare farm in San Francisco a couple months ago. And I said, what are you doing for training? And he smiled. He said, you know, don't you? I said, just tell me what you're doing. He said, target practice. The man who runs Hillary in my home in New York retired early from the Navy, went in the Naval Reserves. He's a Navy cook. He was in the White House mess. And his last weekend reserve duty, he did target practice. Then he went away for summer camp, and he was part of two 12-man groups that were dumped out in the woods on the East Coast and engaged in 2 weeks of intensive guerrilla warfare against each other. He didn't think he was going to do that when he became a Navy cook. And when he came home, he said, I survived, and they never killed me, but I wasn't sure I was happier, and that was the hardest thing I ever did. But it's interesting. Navy guys openly joke now that they're being called an army. So whatever you think about Iraq, the ongoing vitality of our national security, I think, will almost mandate some sort of substantial reduction there. But I think you have to be prepared, again, to echo what I read in the paper that General Powell said. As awful as Iraq has been, fewer people have died there than would have died if the American military hadn't been there. You got to be prepared for this. And all you have to do is look at Bosnia. Both Bosnia and Iraq were multi-ethnic artificial creations of the demise of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I. We didn't do anything in Bosnia for 3 years until sort of the bloodlust was spent and we NATO bombed them for a few days and we went to a peace agreement. We made a deal. But before that deal was made, there were 250,000 dead people and 2.5 million refugees. Iraq is four times as big. Nearly as I can tell, the death rate is 300,000 or 400,000 and 2 million refugees, which means you could have another 600,000 dead people and 8 million more refugees if we disengage altogether before the process plays itself out and politics can assert itself. That's a horrible thing to contemplate. But we can't, if the numbers were the same, which should tell you the answer to an interesting question. Why did Iran want to talk to us about Iraq? Not why did we want to talk to them. Why did they want to talk to us? Their policy so far has been easy. Anybody could have it. Their policy is whatever makes America miserable. I mean, from their point of view, our policy was we went out in the middle of a desert, put down 4 stakes in the ground, tied ourselves to the stake, and had someone pour 4,000 red ants over us and said, okay, let's fight. But if we leave, it's their problem. Where do you think those millions of refugees will go? So it's a dangerous situation. If Iran develops a nuclear weapon, it could be a dangerous situation for 2 reasons. First of all, I suppose there's some chance that they can actually believe they could use a nuclear weapon on Israel and that the world would not respond. We have to disabuse them of that. We'll have to recreate the Cold War understanding if that happens. Our military options are limited. If we use air power there, since the stuff is underground, we might not get it, and we would almost certainly kill huge numbers of civilians, which could turn public opinion in Iran, which has basically been fairly pro-Western, against us all. It's a dangerous situation. Pakistan is exceedingly dangerous. Oh, the second problem with Iran is if they develop a lot of fissile material, they could give it to the terrorist groups to make small nuclear dirty bombs. And then Pakistan's dangerous for the same reason. If the Musharraf government, with all of its imperfections, were to collapse and radical Islamists were to take over Iran, they would be in charge of a nuclear arsenal. And again, they would be subject, presumably, to the same constraints that kept the United States and the Soviet Union from nuking each other in the Cold War, but they would have an awful lot of fissile material, and the Iranian security services and military is full of people that are sympathizers with the Taliban, with Al-Qaeda, and may be more than happy to let a lot of that material out, so we would be much more at risk of having small-scale nuclear weapons explode God knows where in the world. So I would say those are the danger places. The Middle East is dangerous because if we could resolve it, it would take about half the steam out of the terrorist argument everywhere in the world. So I don't suppose it's as dangerous as the other places because their capacity to do that, but the absence of solving it has created a lurking danger which embraces this whole environment we're discussing.
Former President Bill Clinton speaking earlier this month at the Aspen Ideas Festival. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. Now, back to the moderator, Rick Stengel, managing editor of Time magazine.
Tom Friedman yesterday was saying that our addiction to fossil fuels is fueling both our military and our enemies at the same time. I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about how to, as he put it yesterday, make green, the new red, white, and blue. And in fact, this notion of doing well by doing good is something that could go some ways towards solving a lot of these problems. Is that true?
Yeah, I don't think that our addiction to fossil fuels is the main source of the difficulties in the Middle East. But I do believe that if you're talking about what's the most dangerous place in the world, looking ahead 50 years, the most dangerous place in the world is any place that's either putting too many greenhouse gases into the atmosphere or destroying too many natural resources without which the world can't live. So let me set it up and then I'll go to that. Let's take climate change as a given. And all we really know is that something bad's going to happen. We just don't know how bad it'll be and how quick it'll happen. Okay, we know that. We also know that resource depletion is related to climate change, but operating independently of it. That is, 90% of the world's fishing places are understocked, only partly by overfishing. Excess CO2 in the atmosphere has caused the oceans to bravely try to take up the slack and to suck more in. As they do, it's changing the chemical composition of the oceans, interrupting the food chain of the fish, often destroying microscopic life forms, and preventing a lot of these places from restocking. You've got a loss of trees, a loss of water, a loss of topsoil. E.O. Wilson, the great Harvard biologist, says that we're losing plant and animal species at by far the most rapid rate since the first person stood up on the African savanna 150,000 years ago, and maybe even long before that. And it's possible that resource depletion will hurt us and lead to food wars and other wars even before the worst consequences of climate change. Because, let me remind you, the world's population is predicted to grow from its current 6.5 billion to 9 billion in 43 years. So it took us 150,000 years to get from 1 to 6.5 billion, and we're going from 6.5 billion to 9 billion in 43 years. Almost 100% of those people are going to be born in countries not now able to support the people who live there, which gave a certain air of unreality to the recent debate in the Congress on illegal immigration. It's almost like the people said, let's don't even bother to pass it now. Let's all try to live 20 years and see what real hell looks like. So on the other hand, I do not buy even the conservative UN panel forecast that it would require us to accept a 1% reduction in global GDP to appropriately reduce greenhouse gas emissions. For 30 years, Amory Lovin sitting over there, he's been telling you that you can make money out of this deal. This is crazy. You know, we could have the greatest mobilization of resources in America and the greatest creation of jobs and the greatest effort to reduce income inequality, certainly since we started to suffer from income inequality in the 70s, but I believe since we mobilized for World War II, if we got really serious about this. This is an economic boon. Mayor Bloomberg just put out, you know, he's part of this 40 cities group I work with to try to help them reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. So he puts out New York City's greenhouse gas reduction proposal. All the press is about to propose congestion fee, $8 a vehicle on people that go too deep into Manhattan. And, you know, you can all imagine what the pros and cons are, but Singapore and London have done it, and it's been good for them. But that's a tiny part of the greenhouse gas problem. In New York City, only 20% of our greenhouse gases are from transportation, 80% from buildings and the energy necessary to run them. We have 950,000 buildings. Let's assume 50,000 are maximally efficient and 50,000 are about to be raised. You got 850,000 left. How many people would it put to work? How many jobs would it create? How much wealth would it generate? And how many of those jobs would be lower skilled jobs if we decided to green every roof, change every light bulb, put in the most efficient glass, do insulation where it was structurally appropriate, and put in automated controls on lighting and heating and cooling where the system would bear it in those buildings? I can look out my window in Harlem and I look at all these buildings. Most of them are tar roofs, old flat roofs. On a 90 degree day, after 2 hours, the surface temperature will be about 150 degrees. If you go in and seal off the roof so it doesn't leak, put down sod, and put whatever vegetation the roof will hold, it'll cut the surface temperature of the roof to 80, lower than the ambient air temperature, having drastic implications for reducing greenhouse gas emissions and lowering the utility bills of all the businesses and renters in that building. This is not rocket science. And you cannot outsource these jobs to India. Someone has to be standing on the roof. So I can make the same argument with all the clean energy sources, and it's just right through the deal. I just think it's the greatest economic boon. And let me offer one other piece of evidence, because I don't want to take up the whole period on this. But in the United States, since 1973, when our income started to diverge, we've only had about one period, the last 5 or 6 years of my presidency, when all income groups rose and inequality actually diminished some. Now, I'd like to tell you it was because I was an economic genius, but that's not quite true. We had, in the last 6 years of the 90s, a source of new jobs which paid above average wages, changed the job mix in America, and lifted all groups. It was the explosion of information technology out of Silicon Valley into every element of American life. Right. And it's still going on. That's why people stayed up all night for their iPhone. But if you think about it, there is no job in America that is like what it was 10 years ago. None, not one. They've all been changed by information technology. In my time as president, it was 8% of total employment, 28% of job growth, 33% of income growth. Therefore, you got a different mix. Inequality went down. Median wages went up. We haven't done that in this decade. I think it's because we haven't embraced this decade's source of new jobs. You cannot run a rich country, preserve the middle class, and keep inequality from increasing in an interdependent world unless every 5 to 8 years you find a source of new jobs. You can't do it. And our obvious source for this decade was a commitment to a clean, efficient, independent energy future. You don't have to take my word for it. There are two examples. The two European economies that are probably closest to America's, or at least two of the ones that are closest, are the UK and Denmark. Denmark has grown their economy 50% with no increase in energy use, not one more watt, and a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by generating 22% of electricity from wind. You know what happened? Their unemployment rate's about what ours is, but their wages are going up and inequality is decreasing. The UK is even more like the American economy. When we walked away from Kyoto, and it wasn't just President Bush that walked away from it, let me remind you, before he rejected it and said it would be the end of free enterprise as we know it, the Senate voted against the Kyoto Agreement that Al Gore and I and Stu Eisenstadt negotiated 95-0. It's the only bill I ever lost. I think we lost it before Al Gore got off the airplane from Japan. But I'm sure they voted against it before I even sent it to them. I never got a bill beat before I sent it up before. It was the end of the world. You know what the British said? We like this, but it's weak as dishwater, and we can do better. We're going to beat our Kyoto targets 25-50%. Last year, the then Chancellor, now Prime Minister Gordon Brown, issued a report saying they were going to beat their targets and detailing in like 15 different categories how many new jobs. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of new jobs in every category had been created in the United Kingdom because they made the decision to beat their Kyoto targets. As a result, they have about the same unemployment rate we do, but they have rising median incomes and no increase in inequality. This is not rocket science. And the more we live in denial, the more we're going to pay for it, not only in terms of the burden we're putting on our children and grandchildren, but in terms of the gnawing inequality within American society, which make Americans more reluctant to welcome immigrants, to shoulder new responsibilities around the world, to spend American tax dollars fighting the problems that I think we ought to be fighting around the world.
Now, we've gotten from international affairs to domestic affairs, and there's a presidential campaign going on. I've noticed you have a handsome lapel pin there that says Hillary 2008. So my question for you is, what would be your preference? First gentleman or first man?
I think the Scottish friends of mine have suggested I should be called the first laddie, which would require that would be the easiest to relate to the previous. I don't know. I'm proud of her, and I think she's doing a great job. I hope she wins. I think it'll be good for the country. But this is a very interesting election because it's starting so soon. I think there's a bad reason for that, which is that the calendar's all been jammed up. But the good news is that after the 2006 election, the American people decided, including a substantial number of Republicans and almost all independents, they all decided that what we were doing wasn't working and we needed to find a new way forward, and we ought to launch this great debate about what the terms of our citizenship should be, what the mission of our government should be, what the role of our country should be in the 21st century. It's almost like we passed pushed a restart button or something. And I think that's very healthy. We're having, basically positive campaigns in both primaries with basically serious discussion of important issues. And that's got to be a good thing for America. So, yeah, I have strong feelings about it, but most of my life is what I do now outside politics. It's almost like Hillary and I have switched positions. I do the kind of thing she did for more than 20 years from the time we first met. And I hope very much that she wins, and I'm doing what I can to help. But I hope that whatever I'm called, I'll do whatever I'm asked to do, but I hope whatever it is I'm asked to do, I'll still have time to keep doing what I'm doing now.
But how do you see the electorate? I mean, do you feel that you have that same touch feel for the way Americans are thinking that you used to have, or do you feel a little more distant from it? And what do you see among American voters in terms of an appetite for change? Because some of the issues have been, does she in fact represent change, or are there other people who represent change more prominently?
Well, that's not about substance. That's about labeling presentation. I will say again, it seems to me the country has some very big challenges. We have to restore America's leadership in the world, which involves finding some resolution to Iraq, yes, but it also involves telling people we're back in the diplomacy and cooperation business, whether it's on, you know, and let me say this. The one thing that really bothers me for my country is that I think that when we pulled out of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and the Kyoto Climate Change Accord and the International Criminal Court and all these other things, we stopped cooperating with the Latin American military, something President Bush has since reinstituted. I think that we had an image of ourselves frozen in the minds of a lot of people around the world, and I don't think that America or the president can now get enough credit when they're doing something that's good. This AIDS program has done way more good than harm. Way more good. It's done a lot of good. We work with it in my AIDS project around the world. The president's trying to take on malaria now. I think he did something that I really liked, and apparently majorities of both parties in Congress disagree, but he wants to change the way we give food aid in America today. You got all the food we give to hungry people around the world has to be grown in America, and three-quarters of it has to be delivered on American flagships. The Canadians and the Europeans have changed to allow more of their money to be spent just giving the money to poor farmers in the place closest to the famine, which means more money for the farmers, and the money buys a lot more food and it gets there a lot quicker. And, you know, I think that's a great thing, but I haven't heard a single foreign leader say, boy, I'm glad he did that, because we've convinced people that we prefer to act alone, in Secretary Albright's terms. We prefer to act alone whenever we can and cooperate when we have to, and it should be the reverse. So that's the first thing. We got to get ourselves back in business if we want to lead the world and convince China and India to join us fighting climate change or any of this other business. We have to tackle inequality at home. We can't continue to this. The last 6 years we've had 40-year high in corporate profits, all-time high in the stock market. Every year, worker productivity has increased. But wages are flat or declining, median wages, and there's an increase in poverty among working people, increase in working people losing their health insurance. And Goldman Sachs says two-thirds, Goldman Sachs now, not some liberal democratic think tank, says 64% of the increase in corporate profits is directly due to the ability to depress wages and compensation. So we are now seeing a growing inequality in our country, which is bodes ill for a country that was made great by a strong middle class. We got to do something about health care. It's going to bankrupt the economy. And we can't just raise more taxes and cover everybody, because if we don't fix the system and we don't deal with the rising tide of obesity and diabetes, no matter what we do to cover everybody, the system will collapse on itself within a decade again. We're already spending 16% of our GDP on health care. Switzerland spends 12%, but they have 17.5% of their people over 65, and we're at 11.5 or 12 or something. Nobody else with a comparable age distribution spends more than 11. The difference in 16 and 11, $700 billion a year. So we've got to control costs, cover everybody, and start promoting wellness as well as treating sickness. And if we don't do it, the country will pay an unconscionable human and economic price. So we got big things to do. So are we going to change? You bet we are. But the real question is, how are we going to do it? There is no candidate that won't represent change. So that's just a little cheap slogan. I don't think that people mind the changes that were affected in the 8 years I was president. I had a 65% approval rating when I quit. But nobody thinks we can go back to the 90s either, because that the times are different. So we got to have a Restore America policy abroad and a Restore America policy at home. And they require all changes, all kinds of changes.
Now, I've been very greedy in asking all the questions myself, and there are two microphones up there, so we have time for a few questions from the audience. And while I'll do an interstitial until somebody gets up there to ask a question, what are you reading now that you like? And more importantly, I'd like to know, when do you get a chance to read?
Oh, I read all the time. I read when I'm on airplanes, and I read when I go to bed at night. I just read a great, interesting book called Churchill's Folly about the creation of Iraq in 1921. It takes you back to the days of the end of World War I, the demise of the Ottoman Empire, how a lot of those issues in the Middle East could not be resolved at the Treaty of Versailles, and how it all got carved up. And once you see kind of how arbitrary it was and the maddening dilemmas that faced the British there and the French in their area, it's not surprising that once you took the dictator away, all hell broke loose.
Bill Clinton speaking July 7th at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. After his initial conversation with Time magazine managing editor Rick Stengel, President Clinton took questions from the audience. The first question came from political journalist Elizabeth Drew, who's written several books about American politicians, including critical examinations of both Bill Clinton's first 20 months in office and the presidency of George W. Bush. Elizabeth Drew.
The Republicans, obviously, is a talking point, obviously also to shift the blame, say that your administration failed to get bin Laden. The 9/11 Commission was somewhat critical. I know you did some bombing. What do you say about why anticipating, knowing that he was a problem, the African embassies were blown up, why did your administration not give him and that movement more priority?
Well, Elizabeth, congratulations on speaking for the Republican National Committee. I mean, look, let's just go through the facts here, not the myth. The 9/11 Commission did their best to be anodyne and even-handed because they had a Republican Congress and a Republican White House, and they wanted their recommendations accepted. When Rudy Giuliani said, "I didn't do enough" in 1993, Bob Kerry, who was on that commission, wrote a letter tearing him up. You know, that's their first thing is, well, Al-Qaeda was involved in the first World Trade Center bombing. Nobody on earth knew that. Nobody on earth thought Al-Qaeda was involved in any way in direct terrorist operations. We got every single person that was involved in the first World Trade Center bombing, including an extradition from Pakistan, and put them all in prison. We prevented an enormous number of attacks. The Republicans, let me remind you, when I tried to get Osama bin Laden based on good intelligence, they accused me of wag the dog, and they made fun of me, and they said we shouldn't be doing anything about this. And one of the reasons I thought President Bush was disserved is a lot of his neocon advisors said that we were crazy when we told them in the transition that the biggest problem was bin Laden. They said any fool knew that Saddam Hussein was a bigger threat to our security than Osama bin Laden. This was after the USS Cole. And that I was obsessed with bin Laden. So the same people that are criticizing me now criticized me then because I was obsessed with bin Laden. We dealt with him 4 or 5 days a week, every week, for the last 4 years I was president. I did not turn down one request for the use of force. We tried to mount a CIA operation to go in and take him out. They couldn't do it. We contracted with tribals to try to take him out. They couldn't do it. I was willing to use whatever power I could. We didn't have, until 9/11, any kind of basing rights, remember, in Uzbekistan or any place else. The logistics of doing this were much different. I would have attacked him at the end of my presidency, even though they would have accused me of trying to affect the outcome of the presidential election. But the CIA and the FBI had not jointly certified that he was responsible for the USS Cole bombing, even though we all knew it. If I had been president in the spring of 2001, when they did confirm that, I would have given the Taliban an ultimatum to turn him over or gone after him. But I wasn't there then. So I don't think there's any question. If you look at all the things we did on terror, did I fail to get him? Yes. Did I try? Yes. I don't think there's any question that we were far more obsessed with him, and I don't mind using the word, than the Bush administration. Their obsession was Saddam. You can draw your own conclusions about who should have done what when. I don't think we should be in the business of blaming anybody for 9/11. If you want to blame somebody, blame whoever didn't communicate the message when the two FBI agents called the FBI central headquarters and said, hey, there are two people out here flying these airplanes, and they're not taking off for landing. Should we try to find out what's going on at the flight schools and close the doors of the pilots? That's the only one factual breakdown I can think of that almost 100% sure would have prevented 9/11. Even if we had killed Osama bin Laden, those people were already in America, and they were here when I was president. Do I feel badly about it? Yes. Do I know anything I could have done to have stopped it? I don't. And let me say, when I testified for the 9/11 Commission, I went through several mistakes I thought I made with them. And I do think there are things that I should have done that would have handled some of this better, but being more concerned about Osama bin Laden ain't one of them.
The first gentleman, please.
My name is Matt Spence. I'm a director of the Truman National Security Project. One thing you talked about is the importance of, with our interdependence, of greater need for foreign aid and greater need for caring about the well-being and security of people outside the United States. And one thing that we've talked about earlier at this festival was how we can make the Green Revolution, the Green Movement, more red, white, and blue. And I guess my question is, how do we do the same with development policy and foreign aid? That despite the war on terror and despite these problems that cross borders, American support for foreign aid is still very small, which is only one tool, of course, of what we need to do. And American foreign aid is still less than 1% of what our foreign budget is. So as we're talking about now, as there might be this new opportunity to really make these foreign aid and development questions a real question of not just moral importance, but real national security for Americans, what do you say to the American people to actually care about this in a way that we just haven't before?
Well, first of all, let me say, under President Bush, we have increased foreign assistance in AIDS. We're spending like $5.5 billion a year now on AIDS and malaria and other things like that. That's a lot more than we were spending. Our foreign aid budget is still miserably low. But the main reason is not that the American people wouldn't support an adequate foreign assistance budget. It's that they are still under the illusion that we're spending more money than we are. Like, if you ask the average American, well, how much should we spend in foreign assistance? They'd say, oh, between 3% and 5% of the budget. Well, what are we spending? Oh, 10% or 15%? And the truth is, as you just pointed out, we're spending about 1%. So a lot of this is simply education. I think we need to talk more about it, and we need to get the facts about what we're spending. Second thing we need to do is something I've really tried hard to do in this book, is to show skeptics that you can spend money effectively. You can actually get a very high rate of return on your investment in advancing healthcare and education and clean water and sanitation and economic development. I mean, whenever I give a speech, for example, today, I always say that when Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for his microcredit movement, a goal for which I proudly campaigned for 14 years, he got lots of publicity on the fact that 97% of his borrowers were women and the repayment rate was 98.5%. But from the point of view of a skeptic, the most important statistic is this. 58% of the borrowers of the Grameen Bank used their loans to lift themselves above the international poverty line. 58%. That's a staggering statistic. Bangladesh today has a per capita income of just under $500. It was $340 when he started. Today, last year, Bangladesh grew by over 6% in spite of the fact that it was involved in a horrible political turmoil that virtually paralyzed the country because they have a decentralized, vibrant entrepreneurial sector. So the second thing we have to do is say, you know, we can do this. We can tell people that we can get kids in school for not very much money. And we can show them that. We can show them how these health program works. So I think that's the second thing. Third thing I have to say is we can't have either party switch their position on it depending on whether the other person's in the White House. For example, I was delighted that the Republican Congress would give President Bush more money than they'd ever have thought of giving me to fight AIDS because it meant people were going to live. But if we get a Democratic president next time, will the same people vote against foreign aid when we know that it builds more partners? But if you look at the Millennium Development Program of the Bush administration and the healthcare program, I think they're positive. It's just that we need to do more. And the third thing I think would help is if people understood the relative cost. Let's suppose we decide to really go out there on a limb and fund America's share of meeting the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. With only the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development countries, the richest country in the world, is paying. So if we paid our fair share of that, it'd be about a little over a third, give or take $40 billion a year. That sounds like a hell of a lot of money. The government's budget this year is $2.8 trillion. We spent over $100 billion in Afghanistan, over $500 billion in Iraq. It's essentially about 5 months in Iraq, which affects 25 million people to affect 2 billion. So these are the things we need to put out. But basically, the public is already there. All you got to do is tell them the truth. If the leaders will do the right thing, the public will support them. What the public will not do now is vote against you for doing the wrong thing because it's not high on their hierarchy of values and because their information base is inadequate. So you should try to get their information base fixed, but recognize in the end, in the near term, it's just going to depend on whether the leaders want to do the right thing or not.
We have time for only one more question, and come on ahead.
You may recall last year someone wanted to talk to you about becoming the Middle East envoy. Now that Tony Blair has that job, what do you suggest should be his priorities? And secondly, given his involvement in Iraq, do you think that he still has credibility there with the parties?
Well, first, let me answer your first question first. I believe that what his job is will be defined largely by how much the quartet, and especially the United States, but also the others, the EU and the Russians and the UN, how much they let him do, if anything, beyond his stated mandate, which is to promote economic opportunity. Isn't that right? Promote economic opportunity among the Palestinians. What needs doing is to decide whether there is any way in the wide world to find a nonviolent reconciliation between the Palestinian factions, which will enable them to make sufficient commitments, at least privately, to justify private talks with the Israelis, like those which led to the original agreements that we signed on the White House lawn in 93. Does he have the credibility to do that? He would if all those governments supported him, because the Israelis trust him, because he defended them after Lebanon, which infuriated a lot of the other actors in the area, especially after he supported the policy in Iraq. But you got to understand, you can't help the Palestinians unless the Israelis think you care whether they live or die. I mean, the reason we can make progress for 7 years is even the conservative Israelis who disagree with my policy knew that I really cared whether they lived or died. They knew it mattered to me. And I think Tony Blair's been very forthright in being for a Palestinian state, very forthright in having it as contiguous as possible, as much of the West Bank as possible. And look, I feel some. I told him, I saw him right when I was in London last week, right after the day after he left office. And I said, I feel the same way about you I did about me. I said, you will probably fail. All I know is when you're failing because you're trying, fewer people die. My view is that we should never define success in the Middle East based on whether there's a comprehensive peace on our watch, because that's up to them, not us. All I know is that whenever good people try, fewer people die. And as fewer people die, the possibilities of peace remain open more. So, and look, how crazy is this? The biggest story, the only thing that's pushed Iraq out of number one in Middle East news is the epic battle between Hamas and the Fatah for the Fatah security headquarters, and 90 people die. Now, some of us in this room have been in that building. It ain't that big a deal. And I don't mean to be pejorative in my discussion of the Palestinians. I do not know any Palestinians. I've said this every time I come here. I'll tell you this again. I know a lot of Palestinians. I have never met a poor Palestinian in my life outside the territories. They're the number one per capita income in Ecuador. They control the flour trade in Chile. Every Palestinian I know in America is a college professor or a millionaire. I have never met a poor Palestinian outside the territories. They are the most misgoverned, abused, misused people I have ever seen in all my born days. If the Palestinians would get together, make a deal with Israel, which they desperately want to do now because they're worried about Iran, and the Arabs want to help because they're worried about Iran, within 10 years, the whole locus of economic and political power in the Middle East would be in the hands of the Israelis and the Palestinians, because they would get so rich together, they would make a new Middle East of positive interdependence. That's what I think.
From your lips to God's ear.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
William Jefferson Clinton.
Bill Clinton speaking July 7th at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. The festival gathers leaders from government, business, the arts, and academia for a week-long series of lectures and discussions. It's organized by The Atlantic Magazine and the Aspen Institute. Last week, we featured an Aspen Ideas conversation with former Secretary of State Colin Powell, and we will be bringing you many more programs from the festival this summer. If you would like to hear that program with Colin Powell, just visit our website. It's wordforword.org. There, you can hear this week's conversation with Bill Clinton and any of our previous programs. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcast. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert and Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. We had lots of help this week from Kyle Sisko, and the technical director is Sam Keenan. American Public Media.